There's a little business that I thought that might be fun to take care of. And so being a teacher, one is always looking for a demonstration of knowledge. So I decided, well, what could I do? I'm still getting the ring, huh? My voice is a little booming anyway. And I thought, oh, we'll have a quiz. Yes, and you are all in class to have the quiz. So there's two questions, and if you get the question right, you have a choice between a very nice print by Tony Davis and by Diane Cobb. Unfortunately, not framed, but you can do that yourself. So I brought these along for anybody that gets the right answer. So the first question is, what was the first? I still get a lot of ring. Something's too close to something. I'll just keep going while you figure that out.
I just want to just keep the video mic on and take the other one off.
Or turn it way down. Turn it further down.
You can turn it down.
Okay.
Yeah. So the first question is, think back to what was the first book that Meher Baba published? Further back than that.
Messages?
No.
Questions and answers?
No, come on, you guys. Even further back. 1920s.
Oh, it was a biography of Pablo.
Yes. David.
Come.
Okay. The Kalki Avatar. Second question. Okay. Second question was, what was the second? Where, in what city was the highest of the high message delivered? Yes, you got the other one. There you go. So, anyway, and the last thing, I told you I had a surprise for you, Deborah. I read about the loss of the Touched and Blessed ring that was going to be used as a fundraising. And I thought about that and I went, well, you know, we got these from Jal in the late 60s, and you know, we sold the buttons for $1 and the rings for $2. And it wasn't the ring or the button. It was made out of crummy old metal, pot metal, and kind of an odd comical painting of Meher Baba and all that. It was the atmosphere that it carried when Baba touched and blessed those. You ever see the darshans? They bring by a big bucket, like big basket. I said, Baba, go pink like that. The one time he spent a little bit of, had a little moment of levity with it was, Jal was telling me that they had, it was a button about this big that was Baba's picture on that, and on the other side was a mirror. Now, I don't know, they got it from someplace, you know, that made it, but they put the Baba's picture on that. And so Jal brought them up for Baba to touch, and Baba picks it up like this, and he admires this picture of him because it was a new picture. He's going, oh, it's very nice like this. And then he goes, turns it over and goes, oh, look, there's me too. So anyway, so I thought, okay, so gee whiz, this must have been incredibly important to someone that they had to have this for something. It was their fate to have this, even in whatever way they got it. And for that reason, it's like, once you never feel that this was a crummy deal, that, oh, this person is bad and everything else, it's not like that. It's what is important for them that object carried. I thought back not too many years ago, a professional psychologist that was working at a school I was working at, she says one day, "Oh, I'm just having a horrible time, I can't sleep." "Why is that?" "This entity keeps bothering me. They pushes me against the wall at night in bed, and it just does this and that." And I said, she says, "I don't know what to do. I'm going crazy. I think I'm going crazy." I go, "Oh, wait a second." And I went to my car, and I had a touch and bless button there, and I said, "Okay, put this on the nightstand, and that'll take care of everything." Sure enough, the next day, she's like, "It's all gone. It's wonderful." Now, is she interested in Mayor Baba? Not in the least. Is that button important to her? It is if it got her to get a good night's sleep. But it speaks to people. So, being the fact that even though someone's got it who needed it, there's still a loss here. So, I went and looked around, and I found another Baba ring, Touch to Bless, that I'm going to donate to here, so you guys can have a fundraiser if you want. And seeing that it had some security problems, I'm going to give it to the toughest, meanest dude there is to guard it. So David, would you take it? Hold on, come here. You hold on to this. Okay. You take care of that.
Thank you very much.
And Debbie, you set it up however you want to do that. Okay. Yeah, you won't. You can't make it worse. So,
we're gonna like put in a box or something today and lock it.
Cool.
Up, and then we'll decide. That's a real. That's terrific. And I'm in agreement with you in terms. I lost pendants and the Baba's Touch. I get a hair in it. Baba's Touch in the subway.
That's right.
Coming off my neck.
Yeah.
You know, and it was a loss, but I thought someone has picked it up and it's going to mean something great today.
Yes, it's. It's not our business how it gets spread around. Okay, so anyway, here we are. You've heard Baba refer to this a few times, and we are right in the middle of, as Baba said, the end of the cycle of cycles. His work here, what he did, how he's changed the entire atmosphere of the earth, to now go forward to the new humanity and go into a new phase of learning on a new land, this continent that we're on right now. And so I thought, just, you know, we know a cycle, an avataric cycle is 7 to 1400 years, and a full cycle is seven advents, and that's mathematically a little less than 10,000 years. Okay, so that's a full cycle that we have. So it goes back to the end of Zoroaster. Noah was the last avatar of the previous cycle. So, but is when Baba says this is the end of the cycle of cycles, and it is where is that's why he's here, is to change it over. Then you think, okay, well, does he just mean the last 10,000 years or maybe a million years or what the heck is all about? So I did a little research from In the God-Man. And this is a really good book because it, without a lot of expositional stuff, it tells you everything Baba did, how often he fasted, all of his major messages. Baba was a busy guy. And he had to be busy because in one lifetime you have to, you know, do things like go from the old cycle to the new cycle. So he was always, timing was everything. And on page 275, I came across, Baba actually talked about the cycle of cycles and how long it was. And there he says, he says that all cycles of time and illusion end and begin after 7 to 1400 years. And now here he talks about in the cycle of cycles, he says, and there have and will be millions and billions of such cycles in a cycle of cycles. Yes, there's almost no end to illusion. So then I took and looked, who's got the best calendar for the last billions and billions of years? Not the Chinese, not the Julian calendar. The Vedas do. And yeah. And so with a little bit if you'll indulge me with just a little bit of elucidation on how big the cycle of cycles is, so you can tell. So we know that the Kali Yuga is just over. And a Kali Yuga, according to the Vedas, is about 432,000 years. Okay? Didn't know that. I didn't know that. Before that is the Bronze Age, and that's about 864,000 years. The Silver Age is about 1,296,000. Already things are getting kind of stretched, aren't they, in our understanding. The Golden Age, which starts every section, Mahayuga, is 1,728,000. So add them all together, and a Mahayuga is 4,320,000 years. Whew. That's just one. Now, what the heck is a Mahayuga? If you take it's a half of a day of Brahma. So, there's a Mahayuga and the Mahapralaya. Put them together and they make 8,600,000 years. So a Kalpa, which is a day of Brahma, is 1,000 Mahayugas, which is getting up to where, 4.3 billion years? Didn't they say that the solar system was about 4.3 billion years old? Oh, yeah, okay. One day of Brahma. But that's not the cycle of cycles. If you go from there, the Mahapralaya and the Kalpa, the day and night of one day of Brahma, is 8.6 billion years for one day of Brahma. Now we're talking about the creation is a lifetime of Brahma. So we got one day is 8.6 billion years, almost where they said that the universe, this current universe, has started. But that's one day. So 1 year is 360 days, right, in Vedic terms. And that equals, think of the math, 3.1 trillion years is 1 year of Brahma. How could that be if the universe is only somewhere between 8 and 12 billion years old? Oh, that's because the scientists can't see any further. Doesn't mean it didn't stop. And a lifetime of Brahma is 100 years of his life. So that is, okay, ready for this, 310 trillion years is one creation. That's 310 plus 12 zeros. What does that mean? It means that the cycle of cycles that's just ending is the halfway point. 155 trillion years, the creation has been going on, and 155 more trillion years. Will we be around for that? I hope not. But that's the end of the cycle of cycles, 155 trillion years. And the avatar has been coming back for billions and billions of cycles within that one half cycle. So this is when he says, it's a cycle of cycle. I came back. I'm ending one and I'm beginning the other. It's a lot and a lot of work. So those numbers are kind of, almost too overwhelming. So I thought about, okay, what does that mean for us? We're evolutionary, right? We know for sure that 56 million major forms, from the most primitive form up to the highest animal form, from the gas forms on up, major form. Doesn't mean that we didn't do a bunch of different ones. And how long are you a rock in the... And then you're the next rock and stuff. But we know 8,400,000 human lives is part of the evolutionary part before involution starts. So I did a little math for that. I'm a math teacher, right? Forgive me. And I averaged out from your lives, from like the briefest life you have to the longest life you have, and came up with a nice number of 30 years. That's about average. So 30 years of living. And then 30 years of your second half of your life being out of your body. So you have a total of 60 years for one life. Now, if you multiply 60 times 8,400,000, anybody done that lately? No. It comes out to about 500 million years. Okay, so that's about evolution's period. Now, even let's assume we're at the very end of this. Go back 500 million years on this Earth, and where were we? It's Precambrian. There was no oxygen in the atmosphere. There was trilobites and ammonites and some little creepy things in the ground swimming in the ocean. No fish yet. Were we on this Earth at the beginning of our human form? No. So that's kind of the how big the perspective is. And I know that Mayor Baba at one time said, there's been at least two prior creations to this one. So then we're getting into how many trillion years has that been going on? It's almost infinite, but not quite. So anyway, it is that's going on. And here, leave it to Mayor Baba to do a change that normally a big step in evolution would be 4.3 billion years as a Mahapralaya. It's where the universe is inhaled and then pushed out again as a next step up. He's doing it in 600. Not only is he doing it in 600, he's inviting us all to do it with him. And there's no hazardous duty pay for this and no overtime. So that's what... that's what is ahead of us, is to join him for that work and join him in America for that work, because that's where it's all at right now. So now, all those dumb numbers are done. The first half of, until 1952, Mayor Baba functioned as a perfect master. He was very clear about that. And not only did he function that, he allowed him to be called the perfect master, Sri Sadhguru, Mayor Baba. He worked with his disciples, his mandali, his greater circle, the people in the West, all learning to be good disciples for the avatar, for his work. And during that period of time, as a perfect master, even though he was the avatar, as a perfect master, he had all the limitations that one would have, the new life, surrendering his divinity, suffered for the mandali at different times. When they went on their treks, his feet really hurt, and it was really cold for him, and all the things that we don't expect, but they all were in reality for him. So he, you know, especially in America, he picked some really power-packed people, and the most important of them all were women. Marina Machiavelli and Elizabeth Patterson, who were with him in the 1930s, and then they were charged by Baba with spreading Baba's words. Marina did that, and then find the proper place for his center in the West. Marcia Ivy Deuce, 1947, visited Baba. Baba said that he was going to reorient Sufism as a true spiritual school in the West that all schools could be modeled after. And, of course, suspended the activities of the new life to come to America in 1952. Now, that was an interesting year as far as Baba declaring his avatarhood. We know that in 1953, he delivered the highest of the high message, very powerful. But in 1952, in a little village somewhere in northern India, I don't even remember, the story was told to me, but I don't remember, it's so long ago. Baba was sitting one day, they were the men, and he were on some must tour or something like that, and he took his alphabet board and he spelled out for the first time, Avatar Mayor Baba Ki Jai. And the villagers were just shocked. In fact, to this day, they have, on that day, whatever day it is, they have a big celebration, and they bring out their only elephant and put a big Baba picture on it. And it's a big parade for that's their claim to fame is this, you know, podunky little village that some place or another. So even though most everybody says, yes, Baba announced he was unequivocally the Avatar in 53, it was 52 that he first sort of let the hint out. And he was allowing the Mandali to refer to him as Avatar rather than just Sri Sadguru. So in 52, Baba comes to America. And he comes as the Avatar. And he comes to set his universal center, to sanctify it, and lay the plans. Sorry, guys. And to lay the plans for the Universal Center and the future and all the buildings that are going to be there and everything. I have my reservation for the Must Hotel. Didn't know there was one there, did you? No, there is. In the 40s, he had the Universal Center in the east at Bhairamangala. So there were these two pieces. And this was Baba's home in the west. That's what he said. And also, he chartered the first real spiritual school in the West and reoriented Sufism as a model for all spiritual schools that at the time people were going, what the heck, what are you talking about? But in the future, this is... People didn't realize that America was the hot spot for new spiritual growth. And this is the point that I'm talking to you about. So, and then, of course, had to fulfill what had been, as he said, destined for forever and ever, was he spilled his blood. On American soil. Anyway, so America could not have been, this land could not have been changed without that. It's a weird place because it's the oldest land mass that's still above water, and it is, oh, it's okay. And yet, when Pangaea broke up, North America got separated. It was parts of all the world chunked onto it. There's a big chunk of Europe that slammed into America in what we know as the Piedmont, the northern central part of the East Coast. There's a big chunk of Africa that came whooping up and hit the south. There's a chunk of Asia that came and smacked into the Pacific Northwest, and this was why people migrated here and migrated to those areas. It was their land called them. Unfortunately, or maybe not, California, no one knows where it came from. They checked and we got, the strata and this and that and everything else. No, California's mystery spot X. So that's maybe why we're here. So anyway, so it was transformed because of that. The Native Americans changed the land in preparation for a new wave of learning to come to America. And America, all through the period of time, has been the forerunner in making more divine choices. People look back and say, oh, well, we had slavery and we were this and we were stupid about that and all this. Well, yeah, but it's all relative. There was a time, ladies and gentlemen, when sitting around the campfire on the steppes of Central Asia and you were talking with your Mongol horde buddies, and you said, well, you know, today, I didn't kill everybody in the village. I saved half of them, and they're my slaves now. And all your buddies went, what'd you do that for? Why would anybody want to not kill everybody? And then, not killing everybody and making them slaves was a big advancement. So it's relative to what it is now, and you can't look back and say, well, they were stupid because they did this or they did that. It was the best people did at the time. But the couple things that America did do is that they created, and with the becoming the free country, they created liberty, which was never part of anybody's makeup before that. With the Civil War, they cemented the Union and they created freedom for everybody that came. Not just the people that came as slaves, but everybody that came. And then with the Industrial Age and beyond that, we did something that was basically, you could say that we changed matter, gross matter, into more refined matter. And thus we have electricity and all this wonderful stuff and everything and inventions and all that. Here's the reason why. And it's a shame that people say, well, I want to go back. We should all go back and live in mud huts and be agrarian and, you know, pound the earth and, you know, make our own cheese and everything else. The problem with that is that you really cannot be self-reflective enough to advance spiritually unless you're not worried about where your next meal comes from and where the wolves are going to break through the door. So you have to have a certain amount of comfort to be able to stop and think. Because the person who's got their farm and they're digging in some other country and they're working and they got their yaks and everything else, they're not musing about, well, you know, I'm just really kind of have to read God Speaks Again, and I don't quite get that aspect of the Atman and the Jivatman, right? So America has that. We have lots of energy, and we have lots of, we change matter enough so that there's enough comfort here that people can start to explore that. And we do. We're just into everything. We're so busy, and right now we're in what you would call the psychological age. It's pretty recent. I mean, Freud, not the first guy to do it, it's been done for millions of years, but from Freud on to now, it's not very long. And if you ever look at, go watch an old movie sometimes and see how people talk about the psychological aspects. Well, you're not going to get me to a shrink, or they make jokes of it and stuff like that. Because, and not until the 60s, does this sort of kind of come into its own, and now we use our terminology, it's in our jargon all over the place. So this is a psychological age, meaning that it's kind of nice, well, sometimes it's nice, that if you really like somebody, you don't have to crown them as king or queen. And if you don't like somebody, you don't have to chop their head off anymore. Though that has crossed my mind a few times. But so this is, it's easier to get along, and it's easier to be spiritually inclined to do that. And you got to have a lot of energy to do something like that. So this is what Baba set up when he came in 1952. And then in 1953, the highest of the high message was delivered. And it was in Dehradun, and it was the quintessential piece on who he was, what he was doing, and what he expected of you. And this is something that on September 7th is always a good day to read that. It's not very long, but it is powerful. And because it's too long to read, but I sort of synopsisized what Baba's purpose was, because as the avatar, he asks us to honor this and to join him as the avatar. So he says, Baba says that I'm the highest of the high, and the highest of the high's role is, in Hindu terminology, is Shiva, the transformation. And he says, as Shiva, my role demands that I strip you of your possessions and wants and consume them in fire of my love. We have not grown up with the whole thing of you meet a spiritual person, you ask them for a gift, a boon. In the East, they do. So that's why thousands and thousands of people come to all the different gurus and the sadhus and everything else. And Baba said, you know, I'm not for the many. I'm only for the few. So this was for the Easterners to know who he was. And so he says, if you approach me as the highest of the high, and you truly believe that your Baba is the highest of the high, then you have to understand that I'm the one to take your limitations, not the one to give you your mundane desires. He breaks our binding ties, which is, you would call sanskaras, because that's what binds us. So he says, join me, and only love exists, and only love is real, and love awakens you, so you can join me. So here he is, I'm going to take everything away from you, I'm going to burn you up, all your falsehoods have to be relinquished, but guess what? You can join me. So, and he says, so desire for nothing except desirelessness, hope for nothing but to rise above all hopes. That's the hopeless and helpless phase that he initiated in the new life, which we'll all do in some way. We are doing now in some way, shape, or form, but we'll be better and better at it over the next 600 years. So want nothing, and you'll have everything, and be resigned completely to my will, and my will be yours. That's a big promise to do that. So the highest of the high message comes out in 1953. Now Baba said, this is it, guys. I'm either an ordinary man or I'm the avatar. Whichever one you want, fine. But don't confuse me with sadhus and saints and perfect masters and everybody else. All right, then in 1954, Baba invites the men from the West. So here's his link to the West, to two incredible weeks. And bombshells everybody with the final declaration. Anybody read that lately? Read it. It's pretty powerful. And when people got so freaked out about it that he had to do the explanation of the final declaration, so that everyone doesn't think that three-quarters of the world's going to suddenly just gone. And, you know, it's not a bad deal. You know, if you had, like, the house in a particular neighborhood and three-quarters of the world population was gone, and you just, like, move the bodies out of the house and you can move in. Presiding, you were one of the ones that was alive. So. I don't know how that works. Who knows? Baba only knows. He says, I said this in my language, so you can never understand it. But rest assured, it will happen. So that's all you got to do is just trust that it'll happen in one way, shape, or form. So, but it's powerful. It's the way that, you know, Baba, it ties in with what Baba said. Normally, there's not this many people on Earth at any one time, but they're all here for my advent, and they don't want to die. They want to live as long as they can. You know, think about, even 100 years ago, what was the average lifetime expectancy? You were 40 years old, you were the village elder. You know, and it was not, even in the industrial eras, it was 40 or 50, you know, so you were grandpa, ready, you know, coffin, and ready to go. Now, look what we've got, people living in the 80s, and why? To go to Safeway and get some snacks and some cheap wine and go home and watch The Price is Right or something like that? No, they don't know why, but it's because of the avataric advent. Anyway, so again, this is something to really read over and over periodically, and it's in The God-Man, by the way. I'm not pushing this book, but it is a really good book to read. So, and C.B. Purdom was a funny kind of guy, but as a professional author, he really just got it right down the line. He was very, very good. And Baba gave him full access to all kinds of stuff. He was all behind him writing this. So then, after 1954, at the Mensa Harvest, then Baba comes back in 1956 and again in 1958. So he visited America more than any place except for India. and not counting the, you know, including the 30s. And so what did he do finally in 56 and 58? Traveled across the United States entirely, linking them together, the East Coast and the West Coast, the sacred sites on the West Coast and the sacred sites on the East Coast, putting into play his plan for that. Because if you look at both sides, particularly, I mean, there's Bobbison is all over the country, but the two sides, the East Coast and the West Coast, are very dynamic. All up and down the seaboard there, there's lots of happening. And crazy old L.A. has always seemed to have it happening in one way or shape or form in the sort of the spiritual realm of things. So then it culminated this linking the East and the West together, of course, in 1962, the East-West Gathering, anniversaries coming up. And what was it? The Cuban Missile Crisis was going on at that time. Anybody remember that? That was pretty wild, because you were just like waiting for the sirens to go off. My high school and grade school were within view of the anti-IBM missile battery, the Nike missiles, and every once in a while they would like open the doors and those things would come up and you're going, whoa-oh, just practice. And they go back to, you didn't know. And so there was that, and then of course China gets all weird and decides they're going to invade India, and there's a huge battle. There's battles for days and weeks and months that went on the border. And there's stories that you can read in The Awakener and stuff about the people with Baba's grace escaping, being captured, and all kinds of stuff. And it was tense. In fact, there was, at one point, it was like, okay, nobody can come to India, just before the East-West Gathering. And Baba kind of did what he needed to do, and the Chinese backed away. And then there was a relative quiet period just in there, right afterward. Grew up again. So Baba was putting the Easterners and the Westerners together. And so after that point, Baba really then, it was like, okay, I've done all this stuff. Now it's, I just need to finish my universal work. So from 63 to 68, Baba pretty much, there were very less darshans, and even through the, after Baba declared himself as avatar, there were less darshan, mass darshans, because the avatar, that's not his role. His role is a universal role. So there was less, one small one in 1965. And Baba basically went into seclusion at that point, and you couldn't come and see him, couldn't drop in. And later on, it got even so that you couldn't even write to him unless you had that relationship with him from the past. So it was like all of a sudden, whoosh, whoosh, and what the only things we heard from Baba was when he wanted us to help in his work in the last several years. So far, I would come out and say, okay, from this date to this date, you know, fast for 24 hours, take my name for 10,000 times a day. One of the longer ones was saying the Master's Prayer aloud and being on silence. And there was a whole series of things from about 66 through 1968, in 68, the Baba had his lovers around the world take part in doing, which was great for a young guy like me that was just getting into all this stuff to get the family letter or the circular or something. And so it brings it to here in 1966, after searching for pretty much of my young adult life and adult life, trying to find what the heck I was looking for. No idea. And read Christian pieces and translated some early documents, Christian documents, out of Latin. I was really surprised that when I found out after I had taken Latin for 3 years in high school that nobody spoke Latin anymore. I was like, what? Such a beautiful language. So, and then I said, okay, I'm not going to take any more of that. But then finding Buddhist text, the Sufi poets, just everything but nothing at the same time. And so in 66, I was just 19 years old, and I walked into a bookstore in Hermosa Beach, and looking around, yeah, man, you know, the cool age, and the hippies, and all that stuff. And I had tried to figure out, I was looking so hard, it was like, this was when Alan Cohen and Richard Alpert and Timothy Leary were all at Harvard planning on how to get LSD into the drinking water at the UN, so we would all get along together. And it's right in that 66, I think, that Alan wrote to Baba and said, hey, guess what, Mayor Baba? You think that this, you're great, but just, man, if you can take LSD, you'll be even greater. That's what he said. That goes back to the famous, you know, the story of the grapes at Mayor Mount, right? Baba's at Mayor Mount, and he's visiting it for the first time, only time. And in the little room there where that Agnes had Baba's chair there, and then there was places to sit along the side, kind of a long room. Baba says, everybody, I want you to be silent and meditate on me. And then his stomach, and everybody's like, whoa. And he says, this was from grapes. So no more grapes in 700 years. The back to that is that Baba just didn't go and eat grapes because Baba didn't have dairy and he didn't have fruit. But a dear Baba lover from L.A., well, I talked a little bit about, named Dana Field, was on this funny diet. And the funny diet always had bad effects on him. But somehow he thought, if I eat this and I get spiritual, just think what it would do for Mayor Baba. So on the plane flight from Myrtle Beach out to California in 1956 or 50, I forgot which, Dana's bugging Baba to have some, hey, Baba, this is a really good diet, have some grapes. Baba's okay, and he ate a couple grapes on the plane. And so that's where the grape thing came from. But anyway, so there's God Speaks, and I look at it and go, this is interesting. That's a great title. And you see Baba's picture from the back. So I open it up, and there's Baba on the tiger skin, as you know, as Shiva would sit on the tiger skin. And the dedication is to the universe, the illusion that sustains reality. I went, whoa, never saw one like that before. And so it was just before I was drafted into the United States Army, and all through those 2 years or so, there was little Baba pieces. Phyllis Fredericks put a little Baba picture in the LA Free Press, and guess what? Some guy got cookies from his mom, and she wrapped it in the LA Free Press. So while he's eating his cookies, I'm looking at this stuff. And there's a little picture of Mayor Baba again. And I was up at Fort Ord for a while, and it was right after the Monterey Pop Festival. And you ever look at that? I'll tell you that later. There was like Baba posters all over the place. So Baba just kept himself with me, and I thought it was really nice marching 20 miles a day if you take Baba's name at every step. You really get a good rhythm going. Try it sometime. And so I got out of the service, and I came back to my hometown there in the beach area, and found out about Mayor Baba that Phyllis Fredericks was there, and Phyllis was had a little house, and lots of young people were coming to it. And if you read any of the old Awakeners, Phyllis really didn't understand us very much. She was a whole nother era. She worked with and lived with Nerina Machiavelli and Elizabeth Patterson in New York. She was, you know, more like even older than our parents at the time, and was very brought up in a very different kind of environment. And she endured us and love that we had for Baba, and opening this stuff and pushing Mayor Baba out all over the place. We need to have another place to meet. I can't do it in my house. It was in Hermosa Beach. It was a small little place, and it was just getting people out the door. And so she said, I need someplace else. We need to find something else where we can have big meetings. And there was a little Mayor-Bala bookstore that opened in 1968 in Hermosa Beach, but it was really small. And I realized that this was a time for Mayor-Bala to meet Angelo the barber, because the place that I had rented to live in Venice, which became the Mayor-Bala bookstore, was Angelo's barber shop when I rented it. And I scraped the sign off the window and took the barber pole down and stored it. And I was living in a nice big space, rectangular space. And this was, I said, gee whiz, this would be a good place to have meetings. And so I got together Judy Stevens and Terry and Hank Scott and Lefty Stevens and a bunch of people, and we transformed it into the Mayor-Bala bookstore. And in doing so, provided a place for people to come and meet and buy books and sort of create an atmosphere that was in the funky old Venice, which is now all uptown. In funky old Venice, they had a lot of bikers in those days in Venice, and they all were very nice to us. And the community liked us. The police came and visited the first week, and I said, "Oh, here's God on the Hill, and this and that." And they were like, "Okay, good. You're not selling drugs. You're not selling paraphernalia. We like you guys." And the community liked us. They came and people come in and talk, and we were pleasant. And that at the time in LA itself, there was a real spiritual regeneration that was going on. In the 30s was one time Baba came here. The Self-Realization Fellowship, Paramahansa Yogananda, had his place in Mount Washington up here and in Encinitas. And Kirpal Singh came here, and there was the Theosophist here, and the Vedantist, and the Siddha Yoga, and it was all going on. And there was a lot of fakers and spiritualists. It's a crazy place. It's always been crazy. So in the 1960s, all of a sudden, whoosh, a big push again. People rediscovering Self-Realization Fellowship and packing the place. At any weekend, we could go and see Manly Hall, who was a Lumen saint, give a talk, Jay Krishnamurti, go and hang out with Swami Prabhananda, who was a disciple of Vivekananda. There was the Theosophists. There was, of course, who's the guy? The Beatles guy. Maharishi, he was big there. They were like the gurus were coming in and going out. Most of the time they just came in and cleaned out the Hollywood elite, and then they went back on jumbo jets to India with a big chunk of money. But there was all of this going on. The Siddha Yoga, Muktananda, Yogas, buddy, Jay Baba. You come in. This man is the coolest dude. Not only is he Lithuanian like me, but he's about the most creative guy that there ever was, as you can see with that and all his other art, and was just a stalwart in those early days. Talking about the bookstore days down in Venice and all the fun stuff. They asked me to come down here and sort of share. So far, I don't know. A lot of stuff. I'm just talking about opening up the bookstore down there. And so people came and they transformed it. And I was going to put these pictures on. I tried to put them on an iPad, but they didn't work. And I couldn't download it. It's on my email, and then if it messes, but through the magic of photography, I made some large size photos of the Maribaba bookstore. You could pass these around in at that time. And it was, we cleaned the windows off and painted the flowers on it, and people volunteer who we didn't know to come in and paint the thing. And Lefty and I put this big piece of plywood up on the top there, the Maribaba bookstore. As I think about it now, that was probably the least a well-preserved piece of wood up there. It could have fallen at any moment. We just shot some lag bolts into the plaster and hung wires over the edge, but it never came down. But it was transformed into this place, and immediately people started to come. They came walking in from this place and that place and other places. We had visitors of all kinds. People coming in, where's Mayor Bob? I want to talk to him. And then we had started to get invitations to talk about Mayor Baba, and at the local library, and then at get-togethers. And I remember one time Swami Muktananda, who was a true teacher, invited me to come down and give a talk on the yoga of Mayor Baba. Now, he had Sikhs, he had Hindus, he had Buddhists, he was a Vedic teacher, and everybody was talking about, now, with this yoga, are you doing this position and this way, and then you meditate for these many hours and all this other stuff. And you know, of course, in the West, you just can't meditate like that. And you can try, but it's really not conducive to our bodies. Marsha Dusa always said the best way to meditate is to do kind of a walking meditation. You get an idea, an image of Baba, and then you kind of take it, and then maybe it morphs into another little story you heard about Baba, and then something that somebody, and you just play this through your mind instead of trying to reach the, I am not this, I am not that stage, or one of the other things that there are, and concentrating on a piece of fruit for a half an hour a day, and try them all, folks. So I said, oh God, you know, Baba's yoga, and you know, the only thing Baba ever said is the yoga of Mayor Baba is you go to the ego. So I had to kind of extrapolate on that. But when I said that, there was like people's mouths were like, because they were all into this. Well, yes, we want to hear about Baba's famous yoga and everything. And I disappointed them. But Muktananda, no, he knew what was going on. So anyway, so the bookstore opens and people start coming and we have meetings, and soon things began to transpire into getting on the mailing list. And then Phyllis said, you know, Los Angeles is full of these old Baba lovers that I don't see anymore. Phyllis didn't drive, and Phyllis, here's a nice picture, Phyllis. But you have to give that back. Because I've got something on the other side. She didn't drive, and it took hours to get any places. The LA bus system was as bad then as it is now. And so she never went. So she gave us a list of names of people who had met Baba in the 50s or before, and were, she said, I don't know, you can look them up. And so we contacted wonderful lady that everybody soon got to know, Marguerite Poley, who had met Baba in the 50s, and who was a circus acrobat, and then lost her scalp in a machine during World War II. And so, by Marguerite, always had that bandana on her head because it was an ice pack, because there was no skin left on the top of her head. It didn't grow back, so she was always had to be very careful. But she was an artist, and she was this beautiful person. Yeah, that's right, see? And a funny guy named Mr. Sam Rockway. he would come to, usually he came to the meetings once in a while, but he would come to the events, and he followed one time, Baba said, you can choose one of many things to do for a month. Be silent, fast, not read anything, or don't touch money. And he kept that, don't touch money. So he would come to the bookstore, and he would buy a book, and then he would take out his wallet. And in his wallet were these nice, neatly folded little pieces of newspaper. And in it were the different denominations of bills and the change. And so I would take out what we needed and give him his change back. He was silent most of the time. That was just his way. But he was another character that just was, so I didn't know there were Baba people around here. And Bridget, didn't you go and contact Charlotte Sutrang? She was a German or Austrian lady that met Baba in the 50s. You see her in some of the pictures.